One time I was drunk on a morning show in Montana. The host asked me if I had a nickname. Said my friends call me the Dirtbag King. She said on the air I started giggling. Hasn't had me back, but now I've got this podcast. Welcome to my podcast.
Thanks so much for tuning in to A Dirtbag's Guide to Life on the Road. This is your host, Charles Ellsworth, and Dirtbags, I am so happy to have you here this week. We've got a great episode for you. Rob Mellinger from the bands Awful Din and Crazy in the Brains. Let me give him a call while he's on tour in the van driving to Albuquerque. Crazy in the Brains is on tour with Gogo Bordello right now. And so it was cool to get Rob on the podcast while he's on the road, while he's on tour, and experiencing all of that and just talking about being on the road, talking about traveling, ayahuasca, like all kinds of crazy stuff. We really get all over the place. It was a great conversation. I've never met Rob before. This was our first time talking, and it just we just went for it. We got into all kinds of stuff, and it was a really fun conversation. We ended up having to kind of cut it a little short because they were at the gig. They had to go in and get set up and get ready to open for Gogo Bordello. So, but it's a great episode. We talked for a little over an hour, I believe, and I think you all will really enjoy it. It's got everything that it takes to create a great Dirtbags Guide episode. So I'm excited for y'all to get to it. Before we do, some quick things. If you'd like to support the show, the best way to do that is to go to patreon.com/Charles Ellsworth. That's CharlesElsworth. Sign up to throw us a couple bucks each month. $3, $5, $10, whatever you wouldn't miss. It's a great way to support the show, support my ability to continue making music, my ability to keep putting out these episodes, and it just helps me keep going, you know, and the support is really, 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 really appreciated. We're trying to revamp the whole Patreon, get it all ready for the new year, so get yourself in there early. We're going to be doing a sale on yearly subscriptions here soon, so keep your ear to the ground about that. Go to patreon.com/Charles Ellsworth and sign up to become a patron of mine. I would be very, very appreciative of that. It helps so much. Whether you think so or not, $3 or $5 a month may not mean much to you, but trust me, it makes a huge difference in my life, and it's very appreciated. We've got a great group of patrons so far, and a lot of them have been there for a while, and I'm so thankful for each and every one of them. Thank you so much for supporting the show and supporting me as an artist. If you're currently not in a position where you can spend any extra money supporting the show, don't worry. I understand it. I've been there before. There's great ways you can support us without having to spend any money at all. The first, easiest, and most impactful way you can help us out, go to the Apple Podcast app and leave us a rating and a review. It doesn't have to be super long, just a few sentences about why you like the show, and that helps us tremendously. We're so thankful for every review that comes in. Please go do that. If you don't use an Apple Podcast, just make sure you're subscribed to the show on Spotify or wherever you listen to these podcasts. Another way you can support me is by listening to my music. Everybody streams music these days, and I'm on all of the places where you would stream music. My name is Charles Ellsworth, spelled it earlier, CharlesElsworth. Go check out my music, listen to it, find out what songs you like, add them to your playlist that you listen to regularly. Just get my song streaming in your head, in your ears, between your ears. Get you thinking about the stories that I tell in my songs, things like that. If you enjoy the show and you haven't listened to my music yet, what are you doing? You need to go check it out. Make sure you're following, subscribe to me, follow me on Instagram. So check it out. Ellsworth. All of those things. Also, if you're trying to concentrate, meditate, I like to listen to instrumental guitar while I'm doing yoga. And so if you have playlists for that sort of thing, add AB Chattis Guy to it. Give it some listens. I've been told that it's very soothing and adventurous, which is a weird thing to call music, but also not. I've just never been told that before. So that was a cool thing to hear recently. All that being said, thank you, thank you, thank you for listening to the show. Please just share it with your friends. If you like the show and you know people that like travel, like interesting characters that would just enjoy this show, just tell them about it. Tell people that you like this show called The Dirtbag's Guide to Life on the Road, that you're a proud dirtbag, and that you suggest that they listen to it too. I recently read a statistic that I made up because I wrote it down on a piece of paper, but that statistic is 90% of all podcast listens come from word of mouth. And so I know it's made up because I just made it up, but that just shows you how important word of mouth is. You should just go tell people about it. If you got people in your life that are looking for a new podcast or that are kind of lost, you know, tell them to come join us. Be like, hey, fellow dirtbag, not all who wander are lost. Come join us. Come into the fold. Listen. Be a part of it. Be a part of the movement that we're creating here. And you can start off by listening to my conversation with Rob Mellinger of Awful Din and Crazy in the Brains right here. Enjoy.
Hey, hello? Rob, how's it going?
Hey, good. How you doing?
Doing all right. Doing all right. You guys are in Texas right now?
We are in Albuquerque.
Albuquerque? Oh, I was just barely off. Nice. Were you just in Texas?
Yeah. We left, we left San Antonio yesterday.
Oh, gotcha.
If I remember correctly.
Yeah. It all tends to blur together after a week or so.
Yeah, seriously.
Cool. Well, how's the tour been so far?
Tour's been great so far. No major hiccups. Like, we actually had a little bit of trouble with a monitor guy in San Antonio, but other than that, it's been awesome. The crowd's been great. Gogo's been great. Their whole crew's been really supportive, really cool.
That's awesome.
But, yeah.
I'm really happy to hear that.
Cheers, man.
Cool. And you're, just so I remember, you're playing bass in...
That is correct.
Crazy in the Brains?
Yep.
And is that what you play in Awful Din as well?
It is, yeah.
Cool. Have you always been a bass player? Like, where did the whole music thing start for you?
It started when I was like 13 or 14. A buddy of mine played guitar and he wanted me to learn bass so we could cover Blink-182's Damn It at like our school talent show. And, he sucked. So I stopped being friends with him, but I kept playing bass. And right around that time, my two other friends picked up instruments. Memory serves, like, randomly. One of my buddies started playing drums. Another one started playing guitar. And I was like, all right, I guess we're a band now. Then we were a terrible band from eighth grade through high school graduation.
That's awesome. What was that band called?
It was called Half Mast.
Half Mast? Like,
Half Mast. Like, you fly a flag at Half Mast. Originally,
gotcha,
it was Hazmat,
gotcha.
But our drummer couldn't remember that. And he misspoke, and we were like, oh, I guess Half Mast is better. I don't know. It was all really, really ill-advised, but we were like 13, so what do you want?
Yeah, totally. No, that's awesome. I mean, awful band names are just part of the deal.
Oh, yeah. Inescapable.
Yeah, the worst is when I meet people in, like, their mid to late 20s or early 30s in Brooklyn, and they have, like, a horrible band name, but they take themselves super seriously, and you're like... Oh, okay. So it's, you know,
like, bro,
I mean,
bro, do you hear yourself right now?
What was that?
Yeah, never mind. What were you saying?
Am I referring to myself? Is that what you said?
Oh, no. I said, like, bro, are you hearing yourself right now? Like, it was a hypothetical. I was trying to make a joke, and it didn't work because we're on the phone, and we don't have a whole lot of, like, visual communication here.
Yeah, definitely. It makes, like, makes that aspect of it difficult, especially because you and I have never had a conversation before this. So
also that,
but it's also like really fun for me because I kind of like, I don't know. It's like we get a kind of picture what each other's like and kind of develop this idea of who the other is. And then we'll meet inevitably at a Crazy in the Brain show or something here in New York City at some point. And then we'll get to like, do that comparison of like how close you were to guessing.
Yeah.
The person,
I'm always way off, like invariably. I'm like, oh shit! All right,
that's good because so am I. I think that's I think that's just proof that assumptions are just usually terrible.
Oh, for sure.
That sounds like a pretty like relatively common story as far as like starting your first band. You know.
Oh yeah,
actually,
nothing wild.
I covered Blink-182's Damn It at a talent show in seventh grade, I want to say.
Hey,
maybe
look
it was
at
eighth
you.
Grade.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did like a Blink-182 song and like a Face to Face song or something like that.
Oh, right on.
Yeah, that was so yeah, very similar experience for me. Where did you grow up?
I grew up on, I don't know if you're familiar with the Main Line in Pennsylvania. It's right outside Philadelphia. It's a really horrible, like, affluent stretch of suburbia.
Okay.
So I guess around, like, Bryn Mawr is probably the biggest touch point.
Yeah, I'm not really familiar with it. I know Philly, but I don't know that area.
Yeah, you're better off.
And then, so you were there up until high school graduation, pretty much?
Yeah, I mean, if you want full bit, I was born in Palo Alto, and we moved to England when I was, like, 4, and then we moved to the Philly area when I was 6. But then, yeah, I was around Philly from, like, 6 to 18.
Okay, cool. What was in England? Why did the folks move out there?
No, my dad got a job there.
Oh, cool. What kind of work? Did he work for MI6 or something?
No. The truth is much more mundane. I'm not sure, like, what company he was working for exactly. He's just, like, he's a businessman. He does business. And when he left his job in California, someone was like, hey, there's this company. They need help. They're in England, though. And he's like, all right, well, this would be good for my career. And I guess it was. So that's what we did.
Oh, cool. I mean, that's young enough that you probably don't remember a whole lot of that.
But... Oh, no, I remember it perfectly, actually. Like, I started developing memories really early. So, I still remember our whole house. I remember my school. I remember a few of my friends. I remember a bunch of, like, weird cultural touch points out there. It definitely had an impact. Plus, I mean, I think, you know, making a move that big when you're that young and already prone to developing memories, I think also, like, sort of sparks a lot of, you know, neural pathways or something.
Yeah, I'm sure that it probably, you know, like, there's a lot of, like, really big things going on and a lot of big change. And so I think there's probably something to that, that, like, those memories become, or, like, core memories form around the change and the before and after and whatnot.
Oh, yeah.
I don't really know. You know, I'm not a psychologist.
I don't either. Let's go with that. Why not?
Yeah. Cool. That's really cool. Do you have, like, a super distinct memory from when you were living in England?
Super distinct. Let's see.
Or just, like, some weird thing that you remember happening or
be fun. Let me think, like, offhand, I don't know. There was a fox hunt in our front. We lived on a farm. Like, there was, like, an old, like, servants' quarters or something. So that was our house, was where, I guess, servants used to live.
Okay.
So over, there was, like, a hedge in the front yard. Right over that was, like, a field of cows, which was
gotcha.
Chill. Well, one morning I wake up and I look out my window and there's, like, dudes on horses, like, hunting a fucking fox, like, through the cow pasture.
Really?
Like, in the morning fog. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if there's anything more English than that. I don't know if that's particularly English, but it feels like it.
Yeah, that sounds pretty English. I mean, I don't know for sure because I'm no expert. But that, yeah, the whole fox hunt thing sounds super, super English.
Yeah.
That's cool. That's a cool, like, weird little memory to have.
Yeah, it was an interesting morning.
I definitely have some, like, super early memories about hunting, but it was like my dad and my grandpa taking me on a deer hunt or something like that.
See, that's cool. I've never been, like, deer hunting or anything. And as someone who, like, eats meat on occasion, I feel like it's incumbent upon me to, like, you know, I should go out and try to kill something. It's like, if I can't kill something, then what am I doing ever eating meat, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a good point to that, or at least understanding where your food comes from. But also,
for sure.
Like, we don't need every motherfucker on the planet that eats meat to kill things. You know,
no,
you
we
know
don't.
What I mean? Like,
yeah, for sure.
And it's also like, I mean, that's just like an advancement of society. Part of it is like one, I do think we should have a better relationship of understanding where our food comes from. But
yeah.
Also, like, part of building a civilization like we have, part of the point is to where, like, you don't have to slaughter your own meat. I don't know,
totally.
Though.
I don't disagree. I mean, I think a huge part of the point of civilization that people have forgotten is abundance, which we have. But I think we forget that, like, civilization is I feel like it was created in order to make things easier for everybody.
Yeah.
And we seem to have this notion that, you know, it shouldn't be that you should, and you should work, like, things, you know, shouldn't necessarily come easy, but I think we have the resources to make things a lot easier for a lot more people. And there seems to be a lot of pushback to that idea.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think, I agree with you 100%. I think society and a civilization exist to make survival easier for everyone, to kind of share the burden in a point, or making sure the burden doesn't fall too hard on any certain shoulders. But I also understand that, like, you know, it's the dichotomy of, like, you can't have good if you don't have evil, I guess. I mean, I don't know if I believe in real evil, I guess. You can't have light if you don't have dark. You can't have...
Right.
You know what I mean? And, like, so we understand that, like, the biggest rewards, at least that I've earned in life, were things that I learned through working, or, like, putting, you know, actually, like, working for something. I think that's an important thing for people to learn, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it should be survival of the fittest, or like that it should be the slog for everyone, or just because I had it harder than the people coming after me doesn't mean that I need to try and somehow make it hard for them.
Right. I feel like that's what, like, no matter what, and no matter what you have in life, like, you're gonna have challenges. And true, I totally agree. That's what makes most things worthwhile, is meeting whatever challenges come to face you. But yeah, there seems to be this, like, I like the people who make it to the top first, they're like, well, I got to pull up the ladder now. Like, fuck you.
Yeah, totally. I had my coworker Billy yesterday said something along the lines of the concept of pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps would be like telling Cyclops from X-Men to shoot his laser at his hands and fly from it.
That's a very specific analogy, but that's great. That original metaphor was made to be ridiculous. I can't remember the full phrase, but it's the same thing as, like, you know, when people say, oh, there's just like a couple of bad apples in the police force, forgetting that the full phrase is a few bad apples spoil the bunch. The point of the phrase "pull yourself up by your bootstraps" is not supposed to be, you know, you're not supposed to say to somebody to inspire them or to chastise them or anything. It was originally satirical because you can't do it. It's not. It's insane. Like,
no, that's, but people, I like mean, it is. It's funny how the, I mean, right or left, whatever you want to call it. There's a specific American libertarian form of thought that,
yeah.
Or there's a certain,
it doesn't,
like,
seem
of...
to understand nuance or metaphor or, like.
Oh my God, they're so bad at nuance, and
it's crazy.
But they're so good at branding. That's the fucked up part. Is like pro-life sounds like such a good thing, but nothing about anything they believe in or that they like, policies that they enact, are even anywhere close to pro-life. It's just it's like pro-forced birth. But it's,
yeah,
like the marketing behind pro-life is, like, I don't know, like the family values thing. But it's like, oh, but we don't tell you
it's
the
not
family,
like,
values.
Family values. It's patriarchal
very
values.
Small. Yeah, exactly. But I mean,
yeah.
I guess that takes us back to the, you know, not to get too into the weeds on that, but like the toxicity of thinking like, oh, I had things hard, so other people need to have things hard, and like kind of just completely disregarding the fact that it's going to be hard regardless. Like, life's just fucking hard.
Yeah,
you know,
for
but
sure.
Like this toxic thing in our culture about, and I, you know, it's whether it's patriarchy or, you know, whatever it is that's forcing us to be, I don't know, have this like this really dumb and narrow-minded idea of like toughness or manliness. It's just kind of,
yeah,
sad and kind of pathetic, and it just kind of more like we just hamstring ourselves as like a progressing society more and more because of that stupid toxic idea.
Oh, absolutely. Like, everyone's got something to prove, but to who? Like, what are you doing?
Yeah, no, that's for real. I mean, I grew up in a family, or like, something I've noticed about my family is that we're all like kind of, for some reason, always think people are watching us. And I know, like, that's just kind of how humans are. But I think people in my family can be, like, really just kind of overboard with that, like thinking that like people are paying attention to you or being kind of like a little paranoid. And
oh yeah, dude, nobody's paying attention to you. They're all too busy paying attention to themselves.
No, exactly. It's like, and the older I get, the more I realize, like, oh, nobody gives a fuck about what I'm doing. Like,
nope.
You've probably noticed this because, sorry, I want to get back more. I end up talking about myself a lot on these things, so I apologize.
That's cool, man. Like, it's a good conversation.
But the yeah, and that's the point of a podcast, just for two people to just bullshit for an hour. So
yeah, exactly.
but the Go-Go Bordello tour that you're on right now, I'm just going to assume that's probably one of the, like, bigger tours or productions you've been involved with.
This is absolutely, bar none, the biggest in production I've been involved with, yeah.
Okay. And I've kind of, like, just recently started interacting with bands that are on that level or bigger and more just, like, in, like, a background, like, working for them type of way, not really, like, performing by any means. I'm still performing to 5 to 40 people in, like, gross bars.
Oh, yeah. I'm still doing that, too.
Yeah, yeah. And I really want to talk about Awful Din because I listen to some of your music and I really dig it. But
sure,
something I've noticed working these, like, these bigger shows or these bigger events that, like, oh man, if you just, like, act like you belong somewhere, nobody's gonna fucking question it. You know what I mean?
Oh,
it's just like,
yeah,
everybody's just caught up in their own shit and making sure that they're doing their job. And it's like, I'm not saying you should go try and push your luck with security guards or whatnot because they have really hard jobs and, like, and they're not gonna put up with your bullshit. But, like, the more and more I've been like, oh, I need to go backstage to this area, but I don't know if I'm allowed back there or I don't, you know what I mean? I'm just kind of, like, a little anxious about, like, and I'm just like, fuck it. I'm getting paid to go do this thing. So I just, like, just go for it. And nobody even looks twice at me.
Oh yeah. 1000%. If you've got, like, well, yeah, if you've got the attitude, but also if you've got, like, a wristband or whatever, then yeah, it's like, all right, you belong here. We know.
Oh yeah. The credentials definitely help, but, So to kind of reel it back in from all the everywhere that this conversation tends to go, growing up in Pennsylvania, like, where did you go after you graduated and moved away?
Well, because I went to Sarah Lawrence for, like, sorry, excuse me. Ooh,
bless you.
Thank you. Sorry, so starting over there. So I went to Sarah Lawrence for, like, half a semester and quickly realized that it wasn't for me, and I dropped out and moved back in with my folks. And I worked at the Borders Cafe, for, like, the Borders Bookstore Cafe,
mm-hmm.
for the rest of the year while I, you know, sort of figured out what I wanted to do. But I eventually just ended up going to the University of Pittsburgh, and that's where I graduated from. So I lived in Pittsburgh for a little while.
Cool.
All through college and then, like, a few months after that, which was cool. The music scene in Pittsburgh was really good. A lot of really interesting kids out there. A guy played in just a terrible post-rock band while I was there. But it was cool. I mean, you know, it playing in that terrible band got me some lifetime friends and, a lot of really cool experiences. Like, that was where I really first discovered, like, house shows and stuff. Because when I was playing bands in high school, we didn't know shit about Dick, and, like, we didn't know anyone who did either.
Yeah.
So
that's it's hard to get plugged into people that know anything, because, like, nobody knows shit. Everybody's just faking it.
Yeah.
Eventually,
we didn't even know.
Start getting, like, thousands of people that show up to your shows, I guess.
Well, hopefully, yeah.
Yeah.
So, at the time we didn't even know what we didn't know.
The
concept of a scene was so foreign to me. I was like, what even is that? You know, because we just didn't have one. Or, I mean, we certainly weren't privy to it. Not, I mean, there's definitely a scene in Philly, but we were not a part of it.
That's interesting.
So, yeah.
Like, I do love the Philly scene. I think it's, like, one of the most vibrant and eclectic and cool scenes in the country. So when you said you came from around there, I thought you might be, involved in there, but you were kind of an outsider.
Not even a little bit. Yeah, we were way outside that. Cause we were in the burbs. We were in the rich burbs. Like we were not cool, and we weren't good. Like, so even if we were like somehow affiliated, and this was like back in like the early 2000s. Like I graduated high school in 2005. So
okay,
you know, at best we probably So what was even happening around then? Like, at best, we could have been rubbing elbows with, like, Man-Man or something, right?
Well,
I don't even know who else was there at the time.
My friend Joe's band, actually, they might have been later than that, Algernon Cadwallader, but they...
Oh, yeah. Oh, you're friends with Joe?
Yeah, I made a record with him back in...
Oh, right on. Because he's also in Hopalong now, right? Like, he's the guitarist in Hopalong.
Yeah.
And Hopalong's Philly, and they're fucking incredible.
Dude, Hopalong's the fucking the best. Actually, Joe's been on this podcast.
Right on.
You should listen to that episode. It's a real good one. But yeah,
yeah.
It's funny. I saw Hopalong in Salt Lake City years ago, and was just so blown away by their show that I was just like,
oh, dude,
man, I need to make friends with this band. And funny enough, like a year and a half later, I was making a record with Joe. It was just kind of like really serendipitous the way it all worked out.
That's honestly how everything works out.
Yeah, totally. It really is.
If it wasn't for my horse, I never would have got into college.
If it wasn't for your horse?
Sorry. that's a reference. I forget. It's a bit from, I think it's a Lewis Black bit. I forget, honestly.
Oh, okay.
But the whole point is like
what
everything.
Are you talking about?
Exactly. Right. Like, what does that even mean? Like, how could that even work?
that's the bit is like, if it wasn't for. Oh, okay. I get it now. Okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, no. So I guess you're saying that was pre that era in Philly. Cause I want to say Algernon was like more 2008 to 2012 ish.
I
didn't discover them until I became friends with Joe.
I know, actually, I remember having some friends in Pittsburgh, and that was when I was in college, who were into Algernon, and I hadn't quite got there. Yeah, I wish I did, because they're fucking sick. But, yeah, so I don't know if they would have quite been a thing yet. I don't know what Frances was doing at the time, but I don't think she was a thing yet either. But even if they were, dude, I don't know. I was like, so not a part of it.
Well, yeah. So then your horse got you into college in Pittsburgh.
right. So then I got going to Pittsburgh and I made friends and, you know, and those friends had friends and, you know, we knew a guy who ran a house venue. It was called the Lily Pad. They put on shows like every week. And the biggest act I think they got to play was Pattern is Movement, who I wasn't intimately familiar with, but enough people were like, whoa, that's a get. Like, that's a big deal.
I cool. heard of that band, and I was more West Coast for all of that time, so.
Right on. Know, yeah, no, it was pretty cool. People showed up to that one. But, yeah, that was like, you know, I didn't really know about, like, house shows before that. I didn't know people who were in, like, good bands who made interesting music. Like, you know, your friends with all these, like, cool post-hardcore bands and, like, indie bands and stuff, you know. So it was just, like, it kind of blew my mind a little bit. Even though, again, we were terrible. I had yet to be in a good band at all. I really wasn't in a good band. At least until I got to Brooklyn.
Well, I mean, that's kind of such a necessary part of it, though, is, like, playing so many bad shows, you know, and so many things go wrong. And I mean, I remember, because I played bass in my late high school and early college band, and, like, I knew the whole concept of playing, like, the root or the fifth note, you know, and just, like, trying to, like, hold it down, but I didn't know about locking in with the kick drum, and I didn't know what a bass
where
the bass sat in the mix,
like what,
or even like
right, what it actually was supposed to do.
Yeah, no idea. I just was like, oh, I'm just gonna kind of follow along with the rhythm guitarist, and you know what I mean. And but then within like once that band broke up, like three or four years later, I had several bands that were like touring with bigger bands, be like, hey, you want to play bass with us? You want to do this thing? And I felt like I needed to go finish college, which was probably the wrong move. But so I said no. But it's just kind of like, you know, wild what 3 or 4 years of playing bass and like trying to like really, really hit it hard and like trying to become like learn about those things. And how much of it you just learn just like while you're there on stage.
Yep. Yeah. Oh yeah. Just the process of doing will make you so much better. Like yeah. It's honestly, experience is the best education you can get.
Agreed. So like when you're playing this band in college, what was the name of the band in college again? I don't know if you told me.
I didn't tell you. No, sorry. It was called a Switch and Signal.
Signal.
Yeah. Named after like a railroad parts company or shit. Sorry. My bad. I'm in the van right now. His bee just came in. They got the window open. Maybe don't include this in the in the edit. anyway. Sorry, so hang on. Alright, there we go. Get out of here.
Out of there, bee.
Yeah. Anyway, Switch End Signal. It was named after like a railroad parts company. Pittsburgh's a long time, old school iron. It's the Steel City. Their trains seriously. Exactly. Yeah. So they named. I was the last. I'm always the last person to join the band. I don't think I've ever started a band since high school.
Okay.
Actually, that's not true. Eventually, I never started a band since high school, but I forgot. Eventually, we did rotate some members, but. That's immaterial, whatever. Anyway, so the band is named Switch and Signal after Union Switch and Signal, like they produced switches and signals for trains. We were just
okay.
God, we were terrible. We weren't terrible, sorry, we were just aggressively mediocre. It was just, you know, repetitive, no vocals, lame post rock. You know, that nobody liked.
Go ahead.
I've been in a bunch of bands that, you know, even when I like the music that we're making, I can't tell if other people would or should like it. So I've been in like a lot of bands where I'm like, I don't know if this is good. I can't tell if other people don't like it or whatever. I don't know. Like, I've been in a lot of bands where people just do not care. So being in bands that where they do is such a gift. Like, I'm so grateful.
Yeah, totally. That's super real. In post rock with like instrumental post rock, it's like, that's not something just anybody can pull off. I can think of like two or three bands at least that I know of, and it's not really my genre of choice.
Oh, dude. Yeah, it's not really mine either.
Like,
it's just like
really, really well.
Yeah. Yeah. And we did not. We did not have the musical background for it. We did not have the raw, just like, you know, creative minds for it. We were just like pretentious college kids. And
just
that
like to make noise.
Exactly. And, you know, again, also not my genre either, but, you know, the they were the friends that I made, and that was what they were into. And I was like, all right, fuck it. You know, that was around the time I was starting to learn to say yes to things, you know, which is how I got to where I am now, just by like saying yes to shit.
No, that's saying yes to things is a really, really powerful tool.
Oh yeah.
Like I said, I wish I had said yes to going on tour with those bands instead of
probably would have been tight
in college.
you got to use it judiciously,
bands,
but
that's true. One of those bands ended up like not the tour that they asked me for, but like the next tour they went on, they were opening for Jimmy Eat World, and I was like, fuck. But you know, when you promise your mom you're gonna get your degree, you gotta get it, I guess.
Yeah,
you're welcome,
you know, all
mom.
Things for a reason. You gotta get your degree. It's fine, you know.
But that's, saying yes, yeah, it's such a powerful and useful tool. When you say post-rock wasn't quite your genre, like, what was? Like, what was really doing it for you when you were in college?
when I was in college, just like kind of like American alternative. I was really into Pavement. I was really into Modest Mouse. Like, you know, fucking bog standards, like pretentious college white boy indie rock.
Like the other thing college white boys listen to that isn't, well, there's rap, there's post rock, and then there's the stuff you were into.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I adored Modest Mouse. Like, Isaac Brock as a guitar player just blew my mind, and as a lyricist, like, blew my mind. You know, as like a baby existentialist who'd only barely begun to, like, experiment with psychedelics and, like, was picking up the guitar and was like, how does he make those fucking sounds? So, yeah, that hit me just right in college. But around that time, I started, like, I discovered, like, the Dismemberment Plan. I thought, like, they were cool as hell. My buddy turned me on to this group. Do you know Gastro del Sol?
I do not.
They were, I don't even know where they're from, actually. It was principally this dude, David Grubbs, and Jim O'Rourke, who, I don't know if you're familiar with Jim O'Rourke. He's a man about town.
Sounds familiar.
He's done a lot. He's produced a lot of shit. He's produced a lot of good shit. And he was like kind of in Sonic Youth for a minute.
That's probably where I know his name.
Yeah. he's kind of in Sonic Youth. He produced? He's produced a bunch of dope shit. And his own music is really good too. And then sometimes their drummer would be this guy, John McIntyre, who is like one of the creative forces behind like Tortoise and the Sea and Cake. Anyway, so yeah, all this is to say, yeah, Gastro del Sol is more pretentious white boy indie that I got really into.
Cool. What brought you to Brooklyn? Was that your next move after college?
Oh God, no, not even remotely.
Oh really?
Yeah, no. So I, goddamn, I had no idea what I was doing. Like, not even a little bit. Like, I didn't graduate knowing anybody. I didn't do any fucking internships or what. And I didn't want a job. Like, that seemed miserable to me. So I eventually got a shitty job working at, like, a credit report updating company outside of Pittsburgh, like, just outside the city. And I hated it. It was fucking miserable. I was going home to visit my folks in Philly, and I was like 5 minutes from the exit, you know, driving from Pittsburgh to Philly, and I flipped my car on the turnpike. Like, there was this fucking truck in my blind spot, and I swerved just like right before I fucking like merged into him, and there was just like this patch of ice on the road. It was like early April. It was April fucking 1st.
Holy shit.
And I spun out. And thank God no one else was involved. But I spun out off the road, hit this hill, and like did one single roll and like boom, landed upright. I was like, oh my God. Okay. But my car was totaled. Like, I couldn't do anything with it. So I couldn't even get to my job anymore. So I was like, thank God. All right, fuck it. I'm leaving Pittsburgh. Like, there's really nothing here for me. My shitty band had broken up. I was in sort of a not great relationship. I could not get to this job that I hated. I was like, fuck it. I'll move in with my parents. I don't care. So I moved back with my folks and started like working at Whole Foods, and I knew I really wanted to travel. So like, there was something, this Austrian PhD student was living with us in Pittsburgh for a minute. It was really, really cool dude. I loved him. He looked like a young Henry Kissinger. But he would just like sit on the porch and
hopefully smoke. Without the war crimes.
Oh yeah, no. Well, kinda. He I know he was involved in the initial coding for like facial recognition. But that aside, he was a great dude. He would just sit on the on the porch and smoke spliffs and drink box wine and do his coding. Yeah, he had misgivings about that. Like, you know, he was a smart dude, but this was back in 2010. We didn't exactly know what that was going to lead to.
Where things were going, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, he had also...
Sorry,
been
I just
the block.
Can't hear Henry Kissinger's name and not remark that he's a war criminal. Well,
oh, because he was.
Everybody needs to know that he's a war criminal.
Oh, God, that's right. He's still alive somehow.
Yeah, somehow he's still fucking alive, but anyway.
Yeah, right? Only the good die young.
That's true.
But, yeah, no, I mean... It's just funny that he looked like a young Henry Kissinger, because he was a fucking teddy bear. I love this kid. So, but I was like, you know, his name is Marcus. I was like, Marcus, you know, how do you trap? Like, I don't have any money. I don't know what I'm doing. Like, how do you go? And, you know, his like weird Austrian accent is just like, yeah, you just, you know, keep yourself open to opportunities and they will present themselves. Like, sure.
Mm-hmm.
So I did. And I remember my brother who, my younger brother is not really anything like me. He doesn't play music. He doesn't do psychedelics. He doesn't, I don't know. He's very different from me. Sweet kid, but we're about as different as can be. But he took me to a party this one time. And this dude was like, yo, yeah. And the dude who threw it was like, yeah, I'm really like trying to ayahuasca. And I was like, I have no idea what that is. He told me about it. Are you familiar with ayahuasca? It's like kind of hip now. So I don't know if that's like a.
Yeah, I'm familiar with it.
Yeah. But at the time, like in 2012, you know, it wasn't as like trendy as it is now.
Aaron Rodgers wasn't doing it in the off season.
Right. Exactly. So I got back to Whole Foods and my coworkers were like talking like, oh, and this Lou, like, you know, it's too bad he's out on disability right now. He's always going on about this thing. He's like who's the what's it? And I was like, ayahuasca? And they're like, yeah. And I was like, fuck, what? So this dude, Lou, he came back from disability and I bent his ear about it. And he was like, oh, yeah, I can hook you up. And he connected me to a woman who was running a retreat center in Peru. And so through him, I was able to, like, get out there, go to this, like, remote village on the Amazon. It was like a 10-hour barge ride from Iquitos to this tiny village called Tenaro Herrera. Stayed there for 2 weeks. You know, with some other like-minded individuals, and experienced a bunch of like really amazing ceremonies, and just also like, you know, living in the village for a couple of weeks. And then I was telling, you know, someone at a Christmas party, like, oh, I'm going to be going to Peru to do like ayahuasca. And they're like, oh, cool. Have you ever heard of the Camino? And I was like, no, what is that? And they're like, it is this walking pilgrimage across the entirety of Spain. I was like, that sounds fucking sick. So I looked into that. And I was like, all right, well, when I come back from Peru, I'm going to go and, like, I'm going to walk across Spain. So I fucking did that, you know, like 500 miles in, like, 33 days. And it was an absolutely life-changing experience. Like, I experienced some, like, actual, like, magical shit that you would not believe me if I told you. And people don't, but fine, they're my experiences, and I believe
it
was.
Tell me. If you have anything you would like to share, I would love to hear it.
I think the most salient instance probably was before I left for Spain, I was like practicing. So I would walk from my parents' house in the suburbs to my buddy's house in West Philly. It was like a 13-mile walk door to door. Yeah, maybe 15 door to door. And, you know, I put on my pack and I'm like, get ready to go. And like, you know, just because I was like, all right, I'm going to have to do this every day. Like, I better get used to it. So I put all my shit in and like I had like this dumbbell and it was like only like a 10-pound dumbbell. It was like, yo, all right, I'm gonna be like fucking Goku, right? Like I'm gonna put extra weight in my pack and train at 100 times Earth gravity and I'll be Super Saiyan and then I can walk across Spain no problem. As it turns out, I am not Goku and I gave myself tendonitis in my right knee like a week before I left. And it did not get better. I hiked the Pyrenees with mad tendonitis in my right knee. It was beyond painful. And I was moving at a snail's pace. It was bad. So
damn, that's fucking insane.
Yeah, all the same, you know, kept going and made friends with some really great folks. And one of them was this dude, Nick, who was like, he was like this young guy from Texas. And he was there to ostensibly like sort of meditate on whether or not he was going to go to seminary, like to become a fucking priest. But he had done sports medicine back in fucking Texas. And I was like, yo, I'll wrap you up. And, you know, we'll, you know, that'll at least help you out a little bit. I was like, great. Awesome. Thank you. So he wrapped me up. We kept walking. We get to this tiny town called, I think it was Navarrete, if I remember correctly. And we go to the hostel there and the guy there speaks no English, but Nick speaks fluent Spanish from his time as a missionary in fucking Belize, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Next thing I know, Nick is taken off this crucifix he has around his neck. He has like this, it's a pewter or something, I'm not sure. And the guy who runs the hostel, Louise, is ecstatic. Like, Nick is just giving this to him. We're like, what the fuck? And Nick is like, yeah, I guess like they can't, you know, they don't have them like this here. So he asked for it and I gave it to him. And we're like, all right. After that, Louise loved us. And he was like, you know, Nick translated, but he's like, basically, if anybody here needs healing, I'm a healer. I can heal you. And I was like, all right, yo, my leg is fucking killing me. So he was like, mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't say that, but I, you know, I raised my hand and was like, yes. And then he was like, okay. And wordlessly, he sat me in a chair. He looked deep into my eyes for like, I don't know. I have no idea how long. It felt like an eternity. It could have been 5 seconds. It could have been 5 minutes. And then from out of like nowhere, he pulls like this chunk of what looked like rose quartz, like the shape of like an AK bullet or something. And just starts running it down my right leg. Like, I haven't told this guy anything at all, like, other than I need healing. Pulls out this fucking rock and starts running it down my right leg, like right where I've got tendonitis, and hurt like hell. But he's just like, if you'll pardon the expression, he's rubbing it out. After, again, I have no idea how much time passed or how long he did it, but he stopped and was like, all right. And I stood up and swear to God, pain was gone. And to this day, this is 10 years ago, never came back. I fucking walked the rest of the way with zero difficulty. It was one of the wildest things I've ever experienced, like this wordless healing experience.
That's insane. That's a really cool story. I've never done that pilgrimage, but I've done a lot of hiking and stuff, and yeah, that seems like a really, really nice time to have somebody to run upon a healer. It's like, it feels like a Dungeons and Dragons.
There were so many times I was like walking, I was like, man, I feel like I'm in a fucking RPG right now. Just like, you know, walking from point A to point B and town to town, like meeting people and having these weird experiences. Yeah.
I'm so happy you said that, because that's how I did a chunk of the Arizona Trail with my brother last year. He did pretty much the whole thing.
But I didn't even know there was an Arizona Trail.
Yeah, it goes from the border of Mexico to the border of Utah all the way through it. Oh. And I did the northernmost 200 miles with him. So I did like the Grand Canyon and stuff. It was really
nice. Yo, 200 miles is nothing to fucking sneeze at, dude. That's awesome.
Yeah, it was fucking nuts. It was amazing. Really cool. But I feel like, because I think we did it in 11 days, and by the end of it, I really feel like I was starting to hit my stride, and I was like, kind of wish I could keep going, but...
yeah.
but that's, I don't know, what you said about... I mean, one thing is, I always say this, is like, you realize that only one thing can hurt at a time. My brother said that before we left. He was like, at a certain point, your shoulder's going to hurt really, really, really fucking bad. And all you're going to be able to think about is how bad your shoulder hurts. But something to keep in mind is that only one thing will hurt at a time. Because before you know it, your foot will start hurting and you'll forget all about your shoulder.
Whoa.
And it's super true. It's super true. It's like, or something that I thought of as like this, like the most painful a blister gets is when it pops. But then also you're like, oh, it's only better from there. Like, yeah, it fucking hurts. But like,
right, but then that calluses up, man. Like,
exactly. So you like, you get through, like, you feel that thing, you feel, you know, that feeling on your foot, the blister burst and your foot's fire, and it feels like there's acid in your shoe. And then, 10 minutes later, you're like, oh, I don't even know, your shoulder's hurting again.
Yo, so on this tour, we've been playing this new song. We've recorded it, but we haven't like released it yet. But Chris has this line in there, you know, before your wounds can heal, they got to bleed.
The truth. The truth.
And it's like, it's that same thing.
No, I really like that. This experience, and you said you had multiple of these, magical, for lack of a better word.
Yeah. Not all of them were as good stories. I bet two other magic men, one of them legit showed up in my dream. He really wanted me to hang out and like do yoga the next morning. He also ran a hostel. But I had to run. I really wish I did. That was fucking stupid. But like, yeah, I stayed in that hostel, and he appeared in my dream. Like his face, he put his finger over his lips. It was like, tranquilo. Like, it was like, oops, I didn't mean to disturb you. I was like, holy fuck, dude. Like, how did you do that?
Yeah, dude,
it was bananas. So, I'm kicking myself for not like fucking hanging out the next morning, but my friends were like, we're going to go. I was like, all right.
Yeah. Also, I mean, being someone who suffers from like way worse social anxiety than I, like now noticing how bad my social anxiety is. And like when I was younger, I didn't realize that's what it was, but that's what made me like not want to do things or like hang out with people or, you know, it's just like, I was just anxious. And so I said, no. And so like, I kind of got to forgive myself those moments while also being like in the future, try and recognize when something like this is happening and say yes.
Cause totally. It's a learning experience. That was like another big part of me learning to say yes was like, yo, fuck my friends. I was going to catch up with them eventually anyway. Like I should have hung out. Like that could have been a really cool experience instead of one, you know, underwhelming anecdote, but Celebi, here we are.
Yeah. I mean, are you, so when you say you had these mystical experiences and whatnot, like, what do you attribute that to? Are you religious? Are you spiritual? Are you just like open?
Yeah, open is probably a good way of putting it. I think both religious and spiritual have these heavy connotations that I don't know if I necessarily subscribe to. I have friends who are magic practitioners. I have passing interest in like the occult and, you know, so much about this kind of stuff, these mystical, these magical, these spiritual experiences is the willingness to believe. They have as much power as you give them. So it's kind of as simple a choice as like, and that's actually a big like chaos magic principle is starting from belief. Like if you sit there and be like, well, it probably isn't going to work, then it's not going to work. But if you sit there and go like, all right, like this ritual is going to have significant concrete effect, then that's the first step. So it's as simple as saying like, you know, I'd rather live in a world with magic than without. And by the simple act of saying that, I've found that it actually does attract these experiences to me.
No, interesting. That's I dig that explanation a lot. And I mean, it's also like you never heard a possession story about a non-believer.
True. That's true.
But,
which is also why I'm like not afraid.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. No. Go.
I mean, but you hear like possession stories are pretty much a staple of human culture for several hundreds of years, like since probably the death of Christ, you know, like, I mean, probably even before, but like, within the concept of like exorcisms and like the Catholic Church, it's like they're pretty common and I believe they're on the rise as of the past like however many years. But
really,
I'm also not an expert on any of this or like reported possessions or something like that. I listened to last podcast on the left sometimes and they said something about that. So if you want to find out more, go listen to I think it was their latest episode. It was like a Halloween one. But anyways, I think there's plenty, you know, I'm a pretty science-based individual, but I also believe there's plenty that, like, science is still struggling to grasp it explaining.
Right. Well, the thing that science is really good at is explaining how. And that's not hard for it to do at all, it seems. It's, you know, just like a matter of, like, time. What it's not good at is why. And I think that's part of the problem as a society, is that we keep going to science to answer the question why. And not only is there probably no real answer to that question, but science is completely ill-equipped to even begin to, like, approach that answer.
No, that's a really good point. I think science is. I mean, that's not the point. That's not what that's not what the scientific method is designed right. to do.
Exactly.
So it's like you're trying to, I don't know what you're trying to, I don't know what I'm trying to say. You're trying to saw a board with a hammer.
Right. It's, yeah, yeah.
It's
totally.
Not designed to use. That's really interesting. Where did your, your religious background, were you in a religious family growing up? Did you?
I was raised Jewish, but like not religiously Jewish. We did the holidays and stuff, which, yeah, I'm still, I'm
were
really grateful for. I was not, again, not religious. And it's so not cultural that I didn't. I mean, I kind of wish I did, just because, especially now as I'm getting older and learning more about the occult, you find out that, oh, a lot of it's rooted in Kabbalah and like esoteric Kabbalah, not like Hollywood Kabbalah. And it's like, man, the background in Hebrew would be pretty cool right now. But c'est la vie.
Yeah, no, that's it's like I wish
yeah.
I had stuck with piano lessons, but I didn't. So now I play guitar half decently in my mid-30s. Well, that's cool. I mean, where did you when you were hiking the Camino, was that where your interest in the occult came from? Like, where did that get sparked?
That's a great question, because it definitely was already kind of there. I'm not really sure when it was codified. It might have been around that time. I don't have a good answer for you. I will say, I think it was right before I went on the Camino. I somehow got a hold of Alan Moore's. Alan Moore had a series called Promethea, which is basically his treatise on magical thinking, on magic. And it goes through the entirety of the tarot and the Kabbalah and like all of that. And it blew my mind. I was like, oh, fuck. And that was like right between Peru and Spain that I was reading that. It was a great time for me to do that. Because I also had some weird experiences during the ayahuasca ceremonies. But I've always been open to it. I've always wanted that. I don't know. I'm sorry. I can't remember exactly when a specific interest in the occult actually materialized.
How old were you when you heard about, I know we're skipping around a bit, but I'm just kind of like unlocking different ideas of you, I guess, as we talk. And how old were you when you found out about ayahuasca, and then how old were you when you actually participated in the ceremonies?
Oh, same year. I was 25. So this was 10 years ago, 2012. This guy told me about it at a party in, maybe it was the end of 2011. And I was like 24 and not yet 25. Oh yeah, shit. That's right. I was 24. It was summer 2011 when my brother took me to this party at his house. It was like a pool party. And he told me about this shit. I thought it was really interesting. By December, which is when my birthday is, I had already planned on going. That was when I told my folks who I was living with at the time, like, hey, I'm gonna go to South America and, you know, participate in this ancient psychedelic ritual. And they were very supportive. I had no idea how they were going to take that. But they thought it was cool.
That's
which
awesome.
Is awesome.
That's really cool.
It was really lucky.
Sounds like your folks are pretty down.
They are. Yeah, they're very chill. For the most part. I was out in Peru that April. Less than a year between. So I was 20. You know, I was about 25 when I heard of it, and I went. Like, it was pretty immediate.
That's really cool. Can you divulge or tell me a little bit more about, like, what the ayahuasca ceremony was like? Like, I had a friend who had an on-and-off addiction with opiates, actually around that time. And we had heard of ayahuasca being like a way for some people that when they do it, they're able to kind of like break that
cycle of addiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so we ended up getting them some ayahuasca, and they didn't do like an actual ceremony. They just kind of did it on their own and whatnot, but they didn't really, it didn't work. They ended up having
to go to rehab later on
and whatnot. And
there's more to it than just like the compound itself. Although I do know people who, I do think tripping balls can really help with a lot of stuff, and have used it for.
I think tripping on acid. Oh, sorry. What was that?
Nothing.
Oh, I think tripping on acid is what helped me eventually quit smoking and drinking.
Hey, right on. Yeah, and it can do that. But you also have to have that that intention. You have to bring that intention to it. And I do know people who have, kicked their addiction to opiates through ayahuasca ceremony. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I think, yeah, just do an ayahuasca by yourself with no familiarity with it and no guidance. It's really important to have guidance. So, I mean, that's what these ceremonies are. Like, you know, you're in a dark room and you're with a shaman. And the shaman administers they call it the medicine. You know, the shaman administers the medicine and you drink it. You lie down, and then, you know, and then whatever happens, happens. But the whole time the shaman is there, and usually, like, he's chanting or whatever, or shaking leaves and stuff, moving the energy around the room, psychically moving around the room himself. There were so many nights where I was lying there with my eyes closed, and I was like, I swear to God, he was right over top of me. And I'd, like, open my eyes and be like, oh, no, he's sitting in his fucking chair, like, on the other side of the room. And one of the other guys there was like, oh, yeah, no, he moves around the room psychically. I was like, whoa, all right, cool.
How many nights did you do it?
So I was there for 10 days, and we did 5 ceremonies. And I'll say, like, I think, you know, my first ceremony, super underwhelming. Like,
I
drank it, and I made some mantra for myself, some sort of self. I forget what the mantra was exactly, but it was something like, you know, where am I going? What am I doing? It was basically that, but a little more profound. I forget what. And I just repeated that over and over and over in my mind until, like, it lost all meaning. And that was kind of it. Like, I didn't go anywhere. I didn't really see. Like, at some point, I felt compelled to look up, and I felt this presence. I saw, like, a white light and felt this presence. It was like, hey, yeah, you're doing fine. Don't worry about it. You can puke now. And I was like, what? And then I puked. And then I was stone sober. I was like, fuck, what? Oh, what the fuck just happened? And everyone else is still, like, in the middle of ceremony. Fucking this one guy I was there with, he was, like, in his 50s. He'd never even been drunk before. Shamans have said before, like, you're not really supposed to talk about people's quote-unquote journeys, but here I am just telling his shit.
I'm sorry.
Point is, like, I'm stone fucking sober, and it's just done. And I was like, well, what the fuck was that? Like, so I kind of patiently waited. Then I walked up to the woman who was running the retreat center. Was like, yo, I'm going to go to bed. And she's like, yeah, are you okay? I was like, I'm like, fine. Like, and she's like, all right, great. I was like, okay.
Meanwhile, other people are just tripping balls.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The subsequent ceremonies were different. Like, I had like a psychic connection with this girl that I had like kind of just started seeing. I just felt like she was there with me, like this unbelievable presence. And the next morning I went to, there was like a little cyber cafe in the village. It's like this like turquoise colored building with like 3 computers and the worst internet access you've ever had to deal with. And I sent her an email. I was like, hey, you know, just thinking about you. Just wanted you to know, like, you were, like, in my dream last night or whatever. You know, just wanted to say what's up. And as soon as I got home from Peru and saw her, she was like, yeah, as soon as I saw your email, like, you had to call my friend because I had the same fucking dream. And I was like, whoa. All right. That's cool. Because, yeah,
wild.
We're in the same
that's
time
really
zone.
Cool.
Yeah. some other, I'm pretty sure I like hung out with the ghost of a cat. There were two kittens in this fucking retreat center, man. And our last day, one of them just like disappeared. No one knew where she went. Someone says she just got like swallowed by the earth. And her, I forget if they were actually siblings or whatever, but the other cat never hung out during ceremony. But that night it did. Like, and it, I remember it came over and hung out with me for a little while. And I felt like paws on my feet. I was like, oh, that's cute. It's like playing with my feet. I look up and it's next to my face. And I'm like, oh, you're nowhere near my, what the fuck? So I just like felt like I felt the spirit of its sibling just being like, who's like working through me and trying to talk to its fucking sibling. I definitely had like snake spirits run through my arms. Yeah. I mean, like just shit that like, you know, you're on drugs, like maybe, but, I don't know. Like, I still have friends who like are part of that scene and really, really get down in the spirit world, like, and have these experiences that I didn't even get close to. So yeah, it's some incredible stuff.
Yeah.
But now it's still like trendy. Now they got like fucking, you know, ayahuasca places. I've done it in Brooklyn and it's like, yeah, this is fine. It's like, this is kind of corny. I don't know.
Well, it's, I mean, to take it full circle back to what we were talking about, like how sometimes having to work for something or earn something makes it more meaningful.
Yeah.
And for you to have traveled all the way to Peru and then been on a 10-hour barge to get to this village and blah, blah, blah. Like,
it was, and that's honestly what I was going for, because that wasn't even the first place the guy turned me on to. He turned me on to some other retreat center, and A, it was twice as expensive. I was like, yo, I can't really afford that. But I was looking at pictures of it. I was like, dude, this looks like a fucking, this is a spa. This is a resort. Like, this is not going to do it for me. Like, I knew I needed to get my ass kicked a little bit. Because, like, I didn't have the language for that we're talking about now, that, like, you know, that you, the challenge is what makes it worthwhile. But somehow I intuited that. I was like, yeah, no, give me something else. It was like, all right, yeah, I got this other thing. And it was that.
Yeah. Well, I'm interested that, like, I grew up playing sports and things like that. And, you know, one of my football coaches used to say all the time is that, like, human beings are naturally lazy, like, beings. We're animals, whatever you want to call it. We want, like, we're going to choose the path of least resistance.
That's true of all nature. Nature itself chooses the path of least resistance.
No, and that's true. So it's like a certain type of human being that ends up being like you being like, I want the full on experience. I want to work for this thing.
Yeah.
Where do you think that comes from? Where do you think you learn?
Honestly,
do you think that's a learned behavior, or do you think what do you think?
That's kind of the nature nurture question. I mean, so I guess I'd have to say both. You know, somewhere deep down inside me, I think just, you know, whatever it is that makes up my fucking animus or whatever is like, yo, yeah, you got to do this. But also, yeah, part of it is definitely a learned behavior. You know, like I said, I was getting kind of a bad relationship towards the end of my time in Pittsburgh. And my ex, she said, like, she was really proud of me for, like, I was, like, working. I was not just working at the fucking credit reporting agency. I was also working at a restaurant on the weekends because, you know, it's the one job. Literally wasn't enough, which is wild. But she's like, I'm, like, proud of you. You're actually, like, really, you're really doing this. You know, I thought you were kind of this soft, sad kid. But, you know, you're stepping up. And I was like, yeah, I am. So also, I mean, a part of it was just to prove to her, like, you know, yeah, I can still fucking do shit. I'm gonna go puke my guts out in the jungle, and I'm gonna go walk across Spain. Like, so, yeah, I'd have to say column A and column B, really.
Yeah, it's some sort of random combination of things that have happened throughout your life that have just kind of led you to this way of thinking. I mean, that's kind of the thing that makes me, like, want to believe in, like, the multiverse, is that, like, you know, there's a version of me out there that that said yes to going and playing bass with that band and going on tour with them. You know, there's a
I mean, there is. I think about that all the time. Like, you know, all the other versions of me out there that are just like sitting around on the couch not doing shit. And the versions that are, you know, tired of their fucking amazing musical career.
Yeah. Well, no, that's true. I mean, the credit report thing that you talk about, I worked at a call center in college that's what, oof, like, we sold credit report repair pretty much.
Oh God.
And so, yeah, I was just over the phone sales. I'm like, there's some version of me that somehow 15 years later still doing that. You know, I don't know if that company still exists or if they're all in prison, but, yeah, I don't know. So this all leads to now-ish, or like, when did you get to Brooklyn? When did you start Awful Din? Member? Like, tell me.
I'm not the original member. Well, actually, so after Spain, I came back and I was like, yo, I've never been to Asia. And I had a friend who was teaching English in Korea, and she hooked me up with a recruitment agency. And I got a job teaching English in Korea for a year.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. Yeah, dude, like, there was a long journey before I even got to Brooklyn, man. I mean, I don't know how much there is to say about Korea. Like, it's a blast and a lovely country, and I was drunker than I've ever been in my life. But the food is amazing. The people are amazing. I made lifetime friends there. It was an astounding experience.
That's awesome.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, to kind of cut it short, because I think we're about to head to this gig. Got back from Korea. And then I was once again fucking aimless and depressed in Philadelphia. And I made it the whole year, and eventually I kind of got the short lease with a chick I knew in college, but wasn't really working out. My lease was up. I was out of money. I saved mad money in Korea because they set you up with a fucking place to live and all this stuff. Like, you know, they really hook you up. Mm-hmm. But I was out of money. I had no fucking place to live. I didn't know what I was doing. And then my uncle calls me and is like, and I mean, this is the dictionary definition of nepotism, but he was like, hey, you know, I know we've kind of talked about this before, but nothing's really happened. I can give you a job right now if you want. You just got to move to New York. And I was like, yeah, all right, totally. Oh my God. So he used to run an ad agency. And I mean, I've been a writer my whole life in like some capacity or another. So he knew I could do it. Like I've got family. Well, there's other members of the family who like had asked him for a job. And he's like, no, like I'm not going to do that. And he straight up called me and was like, I have a job for you if you want it. Just move to New York.
That's
I was
cool.
Like, all right, sure. So that was it. The January 2015, that was when I moved to New York, started working in fucking advertising. And I was like, well, cool. Now what? So I was lamenting to my roommate one day. I was like, man, my bass is just sitting in the corner of my room. I'm not doing anything with it. Like, what the fuck? Like, what do I even do? And he's like, yeah, I don't know, man, that sucks. So he was a really chill dude. Like, he was great. But like, he didn't have any advice for me. I was just like, that was just touching, you know? It's like, what are you supposed to say to that? But literally the next day, I'm on the train going to work, and I look up and I see this guy I knew in college. And I'm like, oh shit, it's fucking Eli, that guy. I walk over and I talk to him. I'm like, hey man, what's going on? How you doing? And he's like, oh shit, how are you? I didn't know you're living here. I was like, yeah, you know, moved here a few months ago. And he's like, cool man. And you know, we're chatting, and eventually it comes up that he's in this band, but he's trying to quit. I'm sorry, there's a car going. Oh my God, this is the biggest beat up old piece of shit car I've ever seen in my life. All right. So eventually comes up, he's in this band, but he's trying to quit. And I remember like, oh shit, he played bass in college. I remember that. And I was like, yo, if you're trying to quit, what kind of band is it? He's like, ah, it's just like 90s kind of alt rock thing. And I was like, yeah, that is right up my alley. Fucking like, do you need to replace him? He's like, holy shit, that would be great. You know, I've been worried about telling this guy, oh yeah, this guy that, you know, you also knew in college, I was like, oh yeah, I remember him. This guy Jeremy, he did not remember me, but we'd like crossed paths a few times.
Mm-hmm.
So he put me in contact, and I joined that band. This is a band called Girl Scout. We played a few shows. Some of them were cool. Like the first place I ever played in Brooklyn was Silent Barn, which I don't know if you're familiar with, like the DIY spaces in Brooklyn. But Silent Barn was dope. You know, before
I know
we lost
that
it.
Name, but I don't know if I ever went there.
It is criminal that is the first place I played in Brooklyn because it was way cooler than I was. So you know.
I played Shea Stadium like way back. I didn't know what the fuck it was, and then I moved, and then Shea Stadium was gone, and I or like, yeah, people were like, "Holy shit, you played there!" And yeah, it's
now, dude. I also played there with this band in Girl Scout. Nobody attended. There was nobody at that show, but you know, I got to play Shea Stadium at least before it was gone.
That's dope.
But after like maybe a year playing that band, it just like, you know, I like that guy, but it just like wasn't really feeling right. So I was like getting ready to quit. I was hanging out at the bar where my ex-girlfriend from Pittsburgh moved to New York and started attending bar before I ever moved to New York. She was already there. And we maintained a friendship. Like, we were still friends. I could not have gotten drunk in New York without her because, you know, I'd go into her bar. She'd be like, she'd buy me a drink. She'd be like, yeah, I don't know, $10. We're like, all right, word. So I was hanging out at her bar one night, and her then-boyfriend comes in. He's like, yo, I'm going to the show at fucking Union Pool. I'm like, yo, I got nothing to do at school if I tag along. He's like, sure. So I go with him, and he introduces me to this, you know, this kid named Steve. And Steve was really into the Jam, and I was like, oh, yeah, the Jam's right. He's like, you know the Jam? I was like, yeah, sure. He's like, cool, man. So I'm in this band. We're, like, about to lose our bassist. And I'm like, well, I'm a bassist, and I'm about to quit my band. And so, you know, like, let's see what's up. Next day, he sent me the record, and I was like, you know, yeah, this is cool. I could do this. There's some power pop stuff. But I was like, I'm down to try it out, at the very least. And excuse me one moment here.
No worries.
There we go. But I can't chew gum and fucking walk at the same time.
Yeah, same.
So I went and auditioned for this band, and I got the part. You know, I was in this band called The Sharp Shadows. And the most important part of that is that's where I met Zach Pless.
I know that name.
Yeah. So we played The Sharp Shadows for a few years, like about pretty much up until the pandemic, when everything kind of fell apart. And then Matt is friends with Chris from Crazy in the Brain. And they lost their drummer, and Matt was like, yo, check out my brother. Zach joined Crazy in the Brain. A few months later, their bassist quit, the xylophonist quit. And Zach texted me. He was like, yo, do you want to audition for Crazy in the Brain? So I was like, fuck yes, of course. And, you know, long story short, eventually I got in. Here I am on tour with Gogol Bordello.
Wild. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Really
Awful Din was a
cool, dude.
Totally different thing. Also, again, serendipitous. It was like Halloween 2019. It was like before Halloween. And this guy, also named Zach, that I knew sort of tangentially, like through the scene, just put out like a Facebook status update and was like, hey, does anyone want to do a Blink-182 cover set for Halloween? And I was like, yo, I already know the baseline of Carousel. Fuck it. I'll do it.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, started jamming out, working on a set. And I go to, because like, you know, every year on Halloween, Brooklyn erupts in like cover sets.
We're in the midst of that now.
Yeah, we are. No, dude, my Instagram stories are just like everything covers that. So I go to practice one night, and he's like, oh, man, so I'm in this band called Awful Din. Our bassist is quitting, but we got this spot at Pooza Fest. It's a punk festival in Montreal. And I was like, well, as you know, I play bass. And I've never been to Montreal. Send me some tracks, and, you know, maybe we can work it out. And I was thinking, you know, it's probably just some, like, shitty punk band, like whatever. I'll do this. It'll be a ticket to Montreal, and then, you know, I'll quit when I'm good and ready. But he sent me a couple tracks, and I fucking loved it. I was like, oh my god, like this is what I want to play. Holy shit! So I tried out, got in the band, and it was dope. You know, became fast friends, and we played a couple of shows. And then the pandemic hit, and Pooza Fest was canceled, and we kind of struggled for a while. But, you know, we kept it together. And then after about a year of the pandemic, we started getting back together, and we did a couple of, you know, we did a couple of live streams, and we started writing material for what would eventually become our the LP we put out in April, Only Constantly. I'm really fucking proud of that record, man. There's like, yeah, that's, you know, it's, that's really got some of my DNA in it.
What's it called?
Only Constantly.
Is that the one that has all the top tracks? Because I listened to the top three tracks on your Spotify earlier. Are those off that
mostly
record?
I forget what our top few tracks are. Two of them should be. One of them, I think, isn't. It's a bit of a grab bag. But at least a couple of them are, yeah, because we released a couple of singles off that record. And
oh, yeah, they're all three of them are from that record. So
great. Then,
I
yeah.
dig it.
Right on. Cheers, man. So, yeah, we had a blast recording that, and we were really happy with it. We recorded it around this time in, yeah, it would have been, yeah, around this time a year ago, 2021. And then we were all set to tour in April, April this year. We were stoked. We get in the van. We go up, upstate, play a couple of weird shows in upstate New York. And then we were supposed to play – we had a day off, and we were going to play Philly the following day. We stop in Brooklyn on the way, you know, from, like, upstate back down. Mm-hmm. And I wake up in the morning to a text from Aaron, our front man, and he's like, I have COVID. Like, fuck.
Oh, no.
So the rest of the tour was jettisoned. The record did not do what we wanted it to do because we couldn't tour it. We don't know what we're doing. Like, you know, it's not like we had a – we did hire a PR company, but they actually refunded our money because they did nothing, which unheard of. But nice of them, I guess. Wish they would have done something.
Well,
at
least you got your money back.
But at least we got our money back.
Yeah, I had a PR company do nothing once, and I was out a few thousand dollars. So
that's usually what happens. So, you
yeah.
know, at least there's that. But now we're just sitting on it and trying to get things going again. But, you know, it's hard. Life gets in the way, and now I'm out on the road for a month. But, I mean, you know, this is a fucking great reason to be on the road.
Yeah, totally. Well, I mean, and it brings to light, like, I had a similar experience with my last record. I think it's a much better record than the attention it got that it should have got, but I think COVID had a lot to do with that. And it sucks. Like there's a lot of Instagram pages that I follow that are having conversations about how difficult the post COVID or the whatever, wherever we are is for touring musicians and for
yeah.
just for music in general. And I love that conversation is taking place, but I'm also wondering, is it just because my Instagram's catered to my interests? Like, does the rest of, like, just average people, like, have any idea how fucking, like, hard it is to do any of this shit?
I think most people don't. And, like, I mean, I think most people don't know how any of this works at all.
Yeah.
Hold on. Sorry, one second.
That time, I'm trying to go.
Yeah, sorry, we're trying to get to the gig, so I gotta wrap this up kind of soon. But to your point, yeah, I mean, not even in just a post-COVID world. I mean, you know, I did some mini tours and stuff, like, before all this, and there's still this notion that it's, like, glamorous and fun and, like, you know, it's a job. Like, I can't even, like, get drunk most nights because I gotta get up. Someone's gotta drive because we're not on the bus or anything.
Uh-huh.
Like, you know, my girlfriend is like, don't sleep with groupies. And, like, there's no groupies. What do you think this is?
Yeah, you're just shotgunning it to the next gig and
totally,
getting ready
yeah.
to go and doing podcasts in between. And
yeah.
I mean, it's a slog. It's a very, very
it's grueling.
Very blue-collar gig. It's,
yeah.
People don't realize it. And
you're paying out of pocket to do it.
Yeah.
If you're doing a DIY tour, you're paying out of pocket.
Totally. And, you know, and sometimes you see a return on that. And sometimes, you know, like, I mean, it's hard for me to take a vacation that isn't a tour. Like, it stresses me out, even because after all these years, the only way I've been able to ever travel is playing music. And so now when I, like, have enough money to just, like, go do something, unless I book a show, it just makes me super anxious.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, dude.
But
I know you got to go, and I mean, we'll definitely have to have you on again sometime because this has been great. I'd love to maybe do it in person so we could, you know, like have that experience.
Hell yeah, dude, I would love that. That would be outstanding.
Well, when you're back, you know, we'll get you on sometime next year when you're back. The record is Only Constantly from the band
Correct.
Awful Din. Awful,
yeah.
D-I-N.
Yep.
It's great stuff, Rob. I really, really enjoyed listening to it. Everyone check out Crazy in the Brains on tour with Gogo Bordello until in the next few weeks in November. And, yeah, dude, let's when you get back to Brooklyn, let's play a show together or something.
Dude, I would love that.
Cool. Well, you know my manager, so.
That's true. I'll have me talk to your people.
Hell yeah. Well, thanks so much for doing this. You guys have a great gig tonight, and be safe out there on the road.
Right on, man. Thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it.
Of course. Peace.
One time I was drunk on a morning show in Montana. The host asked me if I had a nickname. Said my friends call me the Dirtbag King. She said on the air, I started giggling. Hasn't had me back, but now I've got this podcast. Welcome to my podcast.